Hello, fellow Rebel Capitals. Hope you're well. I'm here with my good buddy and real estate expert, Jason Hartman. Jason, what have you been up to lately, buddy?
Hey, George, I've just been busy. I've been selling some of my own properties, and I've made quite a bit of money on them.
Why have you been selling?
Really, really happy. You know, I'm just kind of moving stuff around, scaling back a little bit, simplifying a little bit. I mean, I read this book that was pretty influential about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago now. It's called Die with Zero. That book was going around in one of my mastermind groups, and all the guys were talking about it. So I read it. And that guy really influenced me a bit to just, realize when you have enough money. I mean, during the COVID era, my net worth doubled, right? Like many wealthy people. And so I'm like realizing that I'm not going to live long enough to spend all this money, right? So I've just been kind of like simplifying my portfolio, consolidating it a bit. Because, the old saying, diversification perpetuates wealth and concentration creates wealth. So, I've been doing the concentration thing for decades. Right. And, now I'm just kind of want to have an easier portfolio. Maybe my ROI won't be quite as good as it was, but it's not that big a deal. Like, who cares? Who cares?
Are we just having issues managing property managers?
Yeah, every property you have is going to create more things to think about, more insurance policies, more tenants, more management. And I've just been kind of consolidating a bit. But I did some, none of the three properties I most recently sold were on the market. Okay. So I just basically talked to one of the tenants who, she bought the property from me. This was one of my assisted living properties and, paid quite a nice premium and I carried the paper for her as a seller carry back. So, I got a very nice interest rate and.
But she couldn't have been a tenant.
Yeah. Tenant. Yeah.
In the assisted living?
No, she was the owner of the assisted living business that was my tenant. Yeah, good clarification. If she was a tenant in the assisted living house, I wouldn't have done a very long note for her. Yeah, I would have wanted to be paid back quickly.
Yeah. Okay, we're gonna go down that. We got to keep the jokes. We'll save the politically incorrect jokes for when you and I are talking face to face.
Sure, sure. But just to answer your other kind of like dovetail on your question.
Yeah.
I sold my own house and it wasn't on the market. It was just on the market for rent. I was going to rent it. But, a guy came in, a neighbor actually, and bought it from me. And, that was quite a nice gain. The assisted living was quite a nice gain. I sold two other properties. I mean, these are nice cash outs, nice little exits. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess the first question on people's mind would be, what are you going to do with the money?
Different things. Some is wrapped up in the deal still because I did a carry back on a couple of them. And so I'm the lender now, right? Mm. And so I'm getting 12%. I got 3 points, which was, that's not, that'll beat inflation. It'll beat real inflation, I think, but not by that much. But when you put the points in there and actually amortize that rate, to get your AP, your actual APR, you're probably getting 17%.
Really. Right.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Yeah. So that's what you're doing. Then you're just kind of relaxing and just waiting for the next thing to come up.
Yeah. I'm not hunting for deals extremely well. I mean, I'm not in the same position as most of my customers, right? I've been doing it for quite a long time. So, I've kind of earned the right to be a little lazy and I'm kind of letting myself be a little lazy given after reading that book.
Yeah. I think this really points to how important it is to start off with what your objectives are as an investor. Because your objectives now aren't the same as Jason Hartman's objectives when he was 21 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. Or in my 30s or 40s even, so it's just a different, it just becomes a different game. But I think I really want to recommend that book Die with Zero to everybody. Everybody needs to read that book. It's really a different way of thinking about financial planning. And it's not that it's such a great, incredible book. It's just a different paradigm. The guy just presents it in a different way. And, you know, one of the things he talks about is how you should invest in things that create memory dividends. So we all think about dividends on our portfolio, right? Or ROI, return on investment. But, you know, one of the sayings that I integrated into our business that we have, George, the collective a little bit, was maximize your ROL, return on life. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you know, he really kind of stresses that, which is a good message for someone like me who needed to hear that message. You know, I've always been very focused on return on investment, of course, but you know, there's more than money. You know, you don't want to be the richest guy in the graveyard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that points to that Argentina trip that we just did, that I did with Josh. I mean, that's something that we'll remember for a long, long time. But, you know, I think the moral of the story there is when you go on vacation, I think a lot of times it's even more fun or more memorable if you don't just go on the Carnival cruise to Cancun.
God, avoid Carnival cruise like a plague.
but you know what I mean? But
I get the idea.
You don't do the normal thing that Americans do, the easy thing. Right. You do something that's extreme, that's something that's out of the ordinary, something that gets you out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, really. That's a good idea. Yeah.
And when you get out of your comfort zone, I think that's what you really, that's when you grow as a person. Mm-hmm. But also, those are the trips that you're going to remember for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, almost all progress happens outside of your comfort zone. No question about it. But you know, I guess I would temper that just a little bit, George, with the idea of I've always been pretty rigorous with myself. And, you know, you got to give yourself a break once in a while too, right? You know, of maybe, you know, it's okay to sit on the beach if you've earned it, right? And, you know, so, I mean, I don't know. It depends on everybody. Everybody's at a different place. So,
All right. Well, let's go back to the current real estate market, because that's what everyone wants to hear your thoughts on.
Sure.
I don't know of anyone that has their finger on the pulse of the starter home market in the United States better than you do. Yep. So if you could just briefly explain what a starter home is and the markets you do business in, and then give us kind of what your 30,000 foot level ideas are on that specific niche.
Yeah, and it's very good that you sort of teed up the question that way, because when you talk about the real estate market, it's such a big market in terms of geography in the United States, of course, and all real estate is local, but also segmenting by price is critically important, because the market in entry-level starter homes, those bread and butter houses that we like as rental properties, as investors, is very different than the market for $800,000, you know, single family homes. That's like a third home for maybe most people, right?
It's even their second, it's the second or third leg up the ladder.
Right. Yeah. And so a starter home, it's funny how that definition has changed over the years with inflation, right? Because the average new home in America is about $475,000. Resale. What's that?
How big is that? Just out of curiosity.
You know, it was, that's an interesting question too. It was about 2,300 square feet, but the builders, because housing affordability is so constricted, it's the worst it's been in about 40 years. The builders have actually been building to meet the market because people just can't afford to buy. And so they've been decreasing the size of their home. And that's been a real shift, by the way. It's really an example of what we've all heard of as shrinkflation. Yeah. What's happening with houses. And so the homes... Yeah,
and it ends like, up with your living room.
the potato chips to your living room, exactly. So, you know, you the bag of potato chips is the same size. It's just got more air in it fewer ounces in net weight of actual chips. And so the homes that the builders are building now are about 2,000 square feet, about 300 square feet less. And this is, you know, you talk a lot on your show and to your audience about really dissecting data. And this is one way, if, for example, a year from now, you were to see a survey and it says something to the effect of new home prices are flat. Hmm. Is that misleading? Yes, it is. Because if the former new home was 2,300 square feet And the current new home that they've been building in that past year is 2,000 square feet. The price might be the same, but you're getting shrinkflation. Yeah. So
I thought Kate Schiller included the size of the house in his metrics.
Well, true. I'm not a fan of Kay Schiller. Okay. But Kay Schiller does do, I can't even remember. I did a show on this about 4 years ago about the different indices and the way they do it. Yeah. And one of the big things, my big gripes about Kay Schiller is that, the main index that's cited is only 20 markets, and 75% of those markets are cyclical markets. Mm-hmm. But I want to make sure I answer your other question. I think it was starter homes.
So defining them and foremost, and then kind of where are we where are we not just overall in the United States, but then more specifically in the markets where you do business?
Yeah. So that $475,000 starter new home, and then that slightly less expensive starter resale home, we've got about 525,000 homes on the market now in the U.S. And just for a point of reference, the normal, what's considered normal by most experts, is 1.2 million. At Rebel Capitalist Live in Houston, I remember getting up on stage and telling all of our Rebel Capitalist friends there that we had 244,000 homes for sale in the United States. And that was almost at the lowest point ever, which was 240,000. So
I didn't know that low.
Yeah. As a reference point, inventory has more than doubled off the lowest point in history, but it is still about 700,000 below what's considered normal by most experts. And so that's where we are. And it's a very weird market. A lot of people thought prices would come down because housing affordability absolutely sucks. It is very difficult to afford a home. And in a normal world, that would cause the market to slide and you'd see prices really softening. But the opposite has happened. I mean, they've tripled the cost of mortgage money almost, and yet prices have still been going up. Well, why is that? It's because all of the people with the existing mortgages won't sell. You know, you talk about the lock-in effect. Everybody knows about it now, but a couple of years ago, nobody was talking about it, maybe except me. And so they won't give up those mortgages, which have become a real asset to them, because the deal they'll get, even on a newer, even lesser home, is more expensive than the current home they have. So we've got all of these baby boomers that are now empty nesters because their kids have moved out, and they're sitting in these big homes that normally they would have sold, and they would have bought a condo and gone on a world cruise, for example, right? But they didn't do that. They're just sitting in their big house that they really don't need that big house anymore, and they won't sell it because their deal's too good. And so it's a very weird time we're in.
Right. But to be clear, the prices are pretty much flat in real terms.
In real terms, if you adjust for inflation, that would be a different discussion. And I would agree with you. But a lot of people make the mistake, and that is true overall. So if you own the house free and clear, throughout the last several decades, real estate has not beat inflation by very much. Okay. It's really not the inflation hedge.
No.
When it's just real estate.
You go, right? 1890 to 1997, it's flat.
Yeah. Not disagreeing. But here's the kicker, is that the vast majority of people, at least, since the great expansion of credit in the early 70s, after we went off the gold standard, the vast majority of people leverage their houses. So they get a multiplier effect, right?
Right.
So if they put 10% down and inflation, in real terms is 6%, and the house price appreciates at 6%, that's a wash. But you've multiplied that return times 10. So your return, if it appreciates, is 60%. So you have to give back 6% for inflation. So you've got a 54% net gain based on the leverage.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think an easy way to say that is if you've got a $100,000 house, you put $10,000 down, and the value of the house just goes up in nominal terms by $10,000. Now it's worth 110 grand.
Right.
Even though it's just gone up in nominal terms and it's maybe flat in real terms, it's because the inflation rate was 10%. Since your down payment was only 10 grand,
you doubled.
You're making a lot of money on that. You're increasing your purchasing power substantially. Whereas if you would have paid 100,000 in cash, your purchasing power would be the exact same today as it was when you bought it.
Right. And just to expand on that point you made, which is a good one. So you doubled your money on the house because you put in 10 grand and it went up 10 grand. So that's double. Of course, if you sold it, you'd have to pay a bunch of closing costs and you'd lose all of that. That's why real estate is not a traded asset. It's an asset to buy and hold because you amortize those closing costs over many years, ultimately, when you hold it. So don't trade it too much because you get a lot eaten up in closing costs. But if you did that with a stock or with stocks, bonds, mutual funds, you know, you're not leveraging those the vast majority of the time. I know you can leverage them on margin at 50-50, et cetera. So there, you're putting $100,000 in the deal, just like paying cash for the house, right? So that's the comparison.
Yeah. Okay. And the one dynamic I think is interesting that we've talked about before, so I don't want to beat a dead horse, is the low float, now that prices have stabilized, theoretically could increase volatility. Now, that said, the volatility in the housing market is always incredibly low.
Yeah.
So if you have an increase in volatility in the housing market, that doesn't look like much, right? but it's still a substantial increase. So I always wonder, okay, if we're at 500,000 right now, if we go up to, let's say, 600,000, we have an additional 600,000 come on as far as supply.
Yeah.
Theoretically, that would impact the price more than if we were at 1.2 million. Just like if we have an additional, let's say 100,000 in demand, that would impact the price more than it would at 1.2 million. So I always wonder, you know, on the way up, it's
good. Well, I lost you on one part. Why would adding 100,000 homes to the inventory impact the price more than adding 700,000 homes to the inventory? That seems like that would have more price impact.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
No, what I'm saying is if you've got the inventory at 1.2 million right now, and let's say prices have been, just to keep it easy, let's just say prices have been flat for the last year.
Got it.
Well, that would tell you that there's 1.2 million in supply and 1.2 million in demand.
Right.
So then if you go down to 500, and let's say you add 100,000 homes to that 1.2 million, as far as the percentage of supply that you're increasing, it's not that much. Let's call it 10, 15%, something like
right.
that. But if you go down and if you have the same price dynamic over the past year where prices have remained the same, but the supply is 500,000, that tells you that there's only demand for 500,000 as well. That's right. The interesting thing about the super low supply. If prices are flat, that tells you that there's super low demand as well.
Oh yeah, demand destruction has been exactly what the Fed has been trying to do, and they have achieved that. Because if you look at sales volume during the go-go days, we were selling almost 6 million homes per year in America. And last year, we only did like 4.9 million. So all of the realtors, think of all the settlement people, right?
Yeah.
The realtors, the lenders, the title companies, the
ecosystem screwed.
Oh my God, their business has just totally constricted. And so they're complaining like crazy, and they're so vocal, especially the realtors, right? Because everybody knows 5,000 realtors. And so they're so vocal. And so they've been complaining and whining about how bad the market is, which is true in terms of sales volume. And in a normal world, the sales volume dropping like it has would typically cause prices to go down. But we're not in a very normal world because of all the lock-in effect of the people with the cheap mortgages. So the Fed has just fucked this whole thing up so badly. Like, I don't like the volume is low. Like, our business isn't that great. You know, I mean, we depend on volume too. We're a volume business. When we, you know, when we got more clients that can afford to buy more houses and we have some inventory to sell them, you know, that's a good thing, right? That's increased volume for us. You know, it's volume is down, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah. So let me just get back to those numbers, and then we'll move on, because I want to get your opinion on this recent move with the commissions as well.
Yeah.
But if we're at 500,000, you add 100,000 in supply there, that's going to impact the price more.
Right.
If float was only, it was 1.2 million like it normally is.
Yeah, because it's a higher percentage on the base.
Much higher percentage. And your demand, because prices have been flat, is at all-time lows or is at an equilibrium with supply, which, you know, if we're normally at 1.2, if we're at 500, that tells you that it's extremely low, relatively speaking.
Right. And what George is doing, I think, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but just for the listeners, George is basically using the idea that prices, if you're in a market where prices are flat, then you are at equilibrium. That's a proxy. You're thinking for equilibrium. So if supply goes way up, and demand doesn't follow, you know, that's a problem.
That's right. Yeah. Or to the opposite, it just creates a lot of volatility.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what happened with the commissions? I know there was a big kind of brouhaha about that. Can you explain what happened and then what your opinion is?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, this is the biggest upset that has happened in the real estate industry in definitely in my lifetime, and way before my lifetime. It is huge. So basically what happened is there was this case called Sitzer Barnett, and it was a class action lawsuit in Missouri. And the lawyers basically went to court, and the jury found that the National Association of Realtors and several other real estate companies, including Keller Williams and many others, RE/MAX did settle out right before the trial, about 2 weeks before, for $56 million. And everybody thought, my God, are they crazy? But then they looked like geniuses afterwards, because the jury found them liable of antitrust. And antitrust carries treble damages. So just like my big case that I had a couple of years ago, which was against a competitor, and that was a RICO case, and we won, we got treble damages, okay, three times. So the verdict against NAR and all of the other big real estate companies was $1.8 billion, that's with a B, $1.8 billion. Multiply times three, that's over $5 billion. Now, NAR did just recently settle for like four.
National Association of Realtors.
Yeah, National Association of Realtors, which, just to give you some background on that, I used to be a member, you know, 20 years ago, because when I was in traditional real estate, you had to be a member. And that's one of the other things there that paints them more like an antitrust offender, is that they require you to join, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like these absolutely idiotic left-wing liberal states that are unionized, right? If you want a job, you have to join the union, versus a right-to-work state that says, hey, you know, I can go to work in Alabama and I can work in auto assembly. And you know, if I want to join the union, if I see it's beneficial, I can join, but I don't have to get a job because that's a right-to-work, right? And so that's kind of funny that that happened in real estate too. Anyway, so National Association of Realtors, the largest trade lobbying organization in the world with about 1.5 million realtor members, they settled maybe a month ago for just over $400 million, which was probably a good decision versus $5 billion. Now, the $5 billion wasn't just against them. It was against multiple companies. And, you know, some companies are settling out. But what happened, George, is it created, you know, ambulance chasing lawyers, okay? It created a whole bunch of other copycat lawsuits all around the country. And so the real estate industry is in absolute turmoil. Now, as part of the settlement, National Association of Realtors agreed on a really unusual thing. And the way our multiple listing service works, our MLS in the United States, is that a listing agent will take the listing, they'll publish that listing in the MLS, and as part of publishing that listing, they will offer a certain amount of commission to what's called a cooperating broker or a selling agent. And that commission has, it's certainly not fixed by law and never has been. However, a lot of people thought that the general rule was you get 3% for listing it and 3% to the selling agent. And so that whole 6% idea came up. And in the past several years, that's definitely been going down as prices have gone up, which, you know, is great. But the problem is now it's going to become chaos. And all of this goes into effect in July. This summer is going to be pandemonium in the real estate industry. I don't know what's going to happen. But basically, here's what they said. They said, you can publish a listing in the MLS and you don't have to offer any commission at all. So if you want to buy a house, what agent is going to work with you? I mean, buyers were never very desirable as clients because selling a house to a buyer is really hard work. You got to shuffle them around to all these properties. There's
100 houses and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and they like this, they don't like that. And even if they do like that one, can they get it? There might be other offers to compete with. And, you know, maybe they can't qualify. It's a nightmare to work with buyers. When I was a traditional agent, I was a listing agent and I controlled the inventory, which as an investor, I also like to control the inventory. I want to control the asset, right? And so buyer's agents don't like working with buyers anyway. Now they're really not going to like working with buyers. And one of the things that's part of this is that the commission that's paid to the buyer's agent will now have to be paid by the buyer. And so most buyers, at least in the entry-level market, you know, they are scraping together to have a down payment. And so they can't come up with an extra 2 or 3% or whatever the number is going to be, certainly not fixed by law, I want to say that, to pay their agent. I mean, it's...
Because before, just to be clear, before the seller that 3% would come from the seller.
Yeah. Right.
You've kind of baked that into the what you would have to pay as far as your closing fees.
Yeah.
And now what you're saying is that's not coming from the seller anymore, or no. It's just not by law. So the seller can choose to do that if they want.
Good distinction. Not by law and not by MLS rules either. And what's interesting about this
is an actual MLS rule.
Yeah. If you put something in the MLS, you had to pay. You know, because you couldn't just you could pay a dollar, right? Always you could all, but the zeitgeist, I'm going to put it that way, that the general thinking was that if you don't pay a competitive rate, which is free market economics, and I think that's fine, if you don't pay a competitive rate to that selling agent, they're not going to show the property. So as part of that big lawsuit, one of the accusations was that they were steering clients to the deals that paid the most. Now, I actually don't see anything wrong with that because that's free market economics. Of course, I'm going to go where I get the best deal. I'm going to take the job that pays me the most money. I'm going to go out with the best looking girl I can, right? You know, I want everything like anybody. That's just human nature.
Yeah, they're kind of looking at the real estate agent kind of as a fiduciary though.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And that's where the problem is. Broker. Yeah, good distinction. So if that was transparent to the buyer, I think I don't even want to use the word steering because it's like just such a negative word, but the if the buyer knows what each listing is paying, then they would know why their agent is maybe steering, right? But if they don't know it, which most of the times they didn't, and that was a problem, mm-hmm. Then, you know, it is unethical to steer people. Absolutely.
I see. So now what do you think this is going to look like moving forward? What is a typical real estate transaction going to look like?
So I think what's going to happen is the lenders, you're going to see the rules change for FHA, VA, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, where the lenders are now going to basically allow part of their loan proceeds to pay the buyer's agent's commission. I think that's going to happen. I think it's got to happen, or there's not going to be any cooperative industry. An interesting thing.
Buyer will end up paying anyway. It's just it's going to be baked into their loan. Right. They're just going to pay it over the next 30 years because the mortgage company, they're not going to absorb the cost.
Right.
So they're just going to pay it and then tack it on to the 30-year loan.
Right, exactly. They've got to be able to finance in that commission or nobody's going to buy a house. Okay, yeah. It's just going to be a problem. Now, the interesting thing is, and you know, you're worldly, you live in a foreign country. I'm worldly, I've been to 92 countries. Around the world, in my meetings with real estate brokers, and I've done that in about 35 countries, I've gone out and gotten in cars with real estate brokers all over the world. And the MLS system, this kind of cooperative real estate system we have in the U.S., is rare. That's not done around the world. In Australia or in Europe, if you want to see properties, you're going to go to one agent and see what they have, and you're going to go to a different agent and see what they're offering.
Yeah, now, that's here too.
Yeah, and that is super inefficient. I think that is. I think the MLS system
mildly
is a great idea.
But for the investor.
Hey guys, I want to invite each and every one of you to join me May 31st through June 2nd in Orlando for Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the annual conference I do, and this year it's going to be absolutely incredible. We're going to have some of your favorites there as speakers, guys like Jeff Snyder, Mike Green, Real Estate, Kenny McElroy. We're going to have Robert Barnes. They're talking about freedom and liberty. Even Rich Cooper is going to be there discussing red pill issues. This event is all about giving you the intel, the insider information you need to not only survive 2024, but thrive. The whole reason I created this event was to give you the tools you need to build the future you deserve for yourself and your family. This is an event you are not going to want to miss. So to get more information, go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. You can see a full list of speakers we've had in the past. You can see clips from past events. And most importantly, you can get your tickets. As we get closer to the event, the tickets go up in price. So you're going to want to get those ASAP at rebelcapitalistlive.com. And we will see you in Orlando, May 31st through June 2nd.
Because the more inefficient, and you always say this, the more inefficient a market is. That's one reason why, like real estate compared to like FX, the more inefficiencies there are, the more opportunities there are
for the people who know what they're doing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
yeah. For the other guys, you're gonna have a big problem there. Yeah. All right, well, let's go into Plan B real estate investing. Mm-hmm. I really was excited to get your thoughts on this because one of the main takeaways I had with my good friend, Chris McIntosh, who you also know well, is, and what I'm talking about, one of the main takeaways from this Argentina trip is it's actually very, very difficult to get a substantial portion of purchasing power from the United States to, let's just say, Argentina, right? If you're using that as the plan B. So if the stuff hits the fan here in the United States, and Klaus locks up your bank account, right? So you purchasing power outside of the system. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you do that and get down to Argentina without breaking the law? So, you know, if you think it through, let's just say you need $250,000 to get you by over the next 2 years. Well, you can't take the cash because they're not going to allow you anything over $10,000 on a plane.
Yep.
And you can take the gold, but okay, although it might be legal, I can assure you that if you got,
you're going to get stopped. You're never going through an airport with a bunch of gold. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that amount of silver would be totally impractical.
Yep.
Because it's only $20 an ounce. And then I don't know if you saw the trip, but what happened, Jason, and then the other option is Bitcoin.
Yep. Or any crypto, but yeah.
Right. So what happened when we got down there is we were able, and every single city has an area where they have all what they call the cambios, mm-hmm. and that's a change. So you can go down there with your dollars and exchange them for Argentinian pesos, mm-hmm. and use those for the medium of exchange or whatever you want to do. Yeah. They're pretty much everywhere. And a lot of them buy jewelry. But what's interesting is they don't really like gold coins. They definitely don't like gold bars because mm-hmm. there's really not a way for them to differentiate if it's real or any of these things. Yeah. So even if you find one of these cambio guys to buy your gold coin, what we found is you're going to have to take a 50% haircut. So if spot is, let's say, 2,200, they're going to give you $1,000.
Wow, that's terrible. Yeah,
something like that. Now the silver coins, they did a little bit better. We could get close to spot
because they like the smaller denomination. I bet. Yeah,
it was that, and what we found in the this one gentleman that we were dealing with in Cordoba. real nice guy. But it's kind of hard to get them to disclose much because it's kind of illegal what they do there. It's really kind of black market or gray area there, right? Yeah. But this guy was super friendly. And he was saying, look, I'll be honest with you. The only reason I'm buying your silver coins, and he bought one gold coin from us as well because he gave us a decent price, but we still had to take a massive haircut, is he said, it's not because it's gold or silver. It's because I like them because they're coins. And I collect the coins, and I think that I can find a buyer because they're in that form. He said, if this was just a silver bar or a gold bar or something, I really wouldn't have any use for it. I wouldn't buy it from you. And then with the Bitcoin, we were most optimistic about that because what we thought is we could find all these Bitcoin cafes and then just go and just do a peer-to-peer transaction.
And did you?
No. Yeah. we had this, everyone suggested this btcmap.org. I don't want to throw them under the bus, but it is what it is.
Yeah.
The first town that we went to, Mendoza, there were probably 10 or 15 of these little dots on the map that showed you that this vendor accepted Bitcoin.
Right.
So we just went from vendor to vendor, you know, trying to find the coffee shop so we could do a peer-to-peer transaction. And we went to 10 in a row, and zero of them accepted Bitcoin.
Wow. Yeah. And you know, in El Salvador, it's been the same way, I've heard. I mean, that's the Bitcoin country, right? And the adoption, you know, the government created this app so people could trade, and the adoption's been terrible and nobody's really used it. Now, I'm sure some of that has improved with the price going up. So, you know, we'll see. But
yeah, so it's tough in Argentina. What makes it very difficult, and I think you'll enjoy this because for an American, it's really hard to get your head around. I don't want to just pick on gold, Bitcoin, and silver. Any asset down there is almost impossible to sell. Why? It's the banking system. Let's just assume for a moment you've got a house, a piece of real estate that you want to sell. Okay, what are your options? Well, you could go ahead and sell that, let's just say, for $100,000 worth of Argentinian pesos. Okay. Well, first of all, if you have that in the bank, did you know that down there you can only withdraw $40 a day?
God, capital controls to the max, man. That's terrible. 40,
so what happens is unless you have an account outside of Argentina, your money's trapped.
Unbelievable.
If you could take out more per day, then you could take out the cash and hopefully buy US dollars.
Yeah, that is so scary. You have
some sort of hedge there. But if once your money's in the bank, you're screwed. You're done. Right. And it's losing value at 20 to 30% per month.
Yeah, unbelievable. That's insane. Yeah.
So then your other option is to find someone that's going to give you $100,000 in cash worth of Argentinian pesos. But then how are you going to spend that within the next month before it loses 20% of its value?
I know. Yeah.
And then the other option is to find someone that will give you $100,000 in US dollars in cash, right? But then the problem is that's a scarce resource because everyone is hoarding the dollars. So no one is willing to give you those $100,000, even if they want the property. So it's in this weird kind of you're in this weird environment where the sellers really don't want to sell because they don't want what they can get. And the buyers don't want to buy because they don't want to give up the dollars. And the only thing they want to use are pesos, which the sellers don't want. And so it's just completely bizarre. So the long story short here is that even if you were able to get your gold down there, it's not going to do you very much good unless you're willing to take that 50% haircut. And then the problem is you're only able to get like $100 a day.
Yeah.
So if you're a family of four, you know, how do you live on that? If you're just some digital nomad that's 19 years old.
Right, you could do it. Yeah.
Yeah, you're good to go. Yeah. But if you're just a family, that's completely unrealistic. And then if you ever wanted to, you know, sell, let's say, $50,000 worth of that gold to maybe buy a house, well, that ain't going to happen unless you find someone to transact with that also has an account outside of Argentina. So basically have no liquidity for any asset whatsoever. So I was talking to McIntosh about this, and he said that one thing he has thought about personally is going down the list, figuring out where you want your plan B, which country you would prefer. That's first and foremost. then what you do is you might want to buy a property down there, like a single family, just like a starter home that you could cash flow or you could Airbnb. So then if you had to bug out of the United States and you got down to Argentina, at least you would have something that was paying you, assuming you could rent it out, so that you could get by until you can figure things out. So that was a long way of getting at my question, which is, I know you've been to 90 countries. If you wanted to set up a plan B and have real estate as a part of that for that cash flow to serve that purpose, what would be the steps you'd take?
Okay. So there are many, many layers to this discussion. So first off, the great thing about owning foreign real estate as an American is you don't have to report it. Okay. Mm-hmm. You do have to report foreign bank accounts and foreign, I think, companies, but well, if not companies, every company has to have a bank account.
You have to report a bank account that has over 10 grand in it at any point in the year.
Yeah. So that's going to be difficult. But, you know, there are some small little interim steps before we get to the actual real estate. And I think these work pretty well in other countries. Just think about getting out of the traditional bankster system, right? And what I mean by that, you're still in the system a bit, but there are like interim steps like using Cash App and using Wise and using some of these sort of newfangled money apps and systems that go with them. I think those will just give you more options. And they're great for expenses, like when you can't use your Bitcoin to buy a cappuccino, right, George? Amazingly, going all around the world, everything, Apple Pay works everywhere. It's kind of
really, but that would require you to have a bank account outside of Argentina,
right? So you can do these banks that are these online sort of pseudo banks.
I don't know by that is whomever you're trying to buy from, they would also have to have an account outside, and then that would also have to assume that your account wasn't frozen by Klaus,
right? But like with Cash App, for example, you can transfer money directly to a person. You can deposit cash at certain retailers. They can take a deposit of cash. Like you can go to a coffee shop and deposit into your account in cash. What they're doing is basically circumventing the traditional banking system. It's pretty neat. And there are several apps like this. There's Revolut, there's Cash App.
Let's walk through this. If you had that app in Argentina, you wanted to buy a coffee, mm-hmm. how would you do that?
You would have a balance in that app, like in Cash App, right? And you would just use your phone to buy it.
Okay, but then what you're assuming is that they have an account.
They have a merchant account, that vendor, yeah.
They have a merchant account, and they're not going to just say, hey, no, we only take cash.
Right, yeah. You could withdraw cash from ATMs and stuff too. I mean, you know.
How are you going to do that when all the banks are completely out of cash by 10 a.m.?
I can't solve every problem, okay?
And the reason I'm pushing back on that is because once you actually get into Argentina, and because those apps only work if the banking system works.
Yeah, right.
If the banking system doesn't work, those things are pretty much useless. Yeah. It's just like Tether. You know, we found a few people down there that would accept Tether, but that's because they had accounts outside of Argentina. Because if they didn't, you run the exact same liquidity problem that we just discussed with, you know, do you accept these pesos that are going to devalue daily? Yeah. And then no one's going to pay you dollars. It's the same kind of paradox.
I want to show you a souvenir I have. These are Zimbabwe dollars. 100 trillion Zimbabwe. I'll take that. Yeah. You know, George, I mean, look, not all of these problems can be solved, but what people need to do is diversify and have multiple things going on. So I'm just saying that little interim step of using some of these newfangled pseudo banking apps, I think is a good idea. Okay. So the answer to your buying real estate question is, look, you have to set up structures in advance. You have to do things before you need them. Dig your well before you're thirsty. That's a really good thing to do in life, in anything. Okay. And so set up an international company and a corresponding bank account. And it doesn't have to be in Argentina. It could be in another haven for it, right? And then put money in that And then, you know, you can use that money and transfer it around. Now, hey,
if
wire system goes down, if the SWIFT system is invalid, I mean, I don't know. I can't solve every problem.
No, but let's just assume that you're going to buy a plan B in Argentina right now and you want to wire down $100,000. You really want to do that? Because what's that $100,000 going to be worth by the time?
But I wouldn't put it in Argentina. You want to put that in a more stable environment. Okay. So if you put that in a Swiss bank account, for example, you can then wire it when you need it. Right.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear there because you were making it sound like we'll just set up the account in the actual country.
And not in the country where its currency is being debased, unless they have, you know, they may offer in some places dollar denominated accounts, for example, or
yes, other Turkey, I think that would be applicable. And they actually do in Argentina, but nobody trusts them. Because back in, first of all, they give you a horrible exchange rate, which is basically a 50% haircut. But then back in 2000, they basically just did a bail-in.
Yeah.
So that's another layer of this.
Yeah. Like in Cyprus, you know, there is no safety from everything. Everything has a flaw. The best thing you can do is prepare as many things as possible, and they should be diversified things. Right, you do the apps for the convenience. Those are just convenience measures for like daily living. Okay, those you're not going to store your wealth in Cash App. Okay, but you know for daily conveniences, it's quite great. And then you set up accounts in maybe multiple jurisdictions. It depends how much wealth you have, and you know you do those accounts in stable jurisdictions, denominated in stable currencies. And then you use that anywhere in the world that you want to use it.
Okay, so just so everyone's on the same page here, what we would do if we were an American right now is we would say, okay, I want my plan B as Argentina, but obviously I don't want a bank there. But I'm concerned that I'm going to wake up one day with a CBDC in the United States and I'm going to exceed my limit of beef for the month. Yeah. And they're going to freeze my account. And therefore, I can't access my purchasing power, in which case I would want to bounce to Argentina, but I've got to be able to live. And therefore, if I had that Swiss bank account, we would assume that Klaus or the CBDC folks wouldn't freeze that account as well. And that would give you some purchasing power that then you could utilize in Argentina. But let's just assume for a moment that you wanted to navigate completely outside of the system with that $250,000 worth of purchasing power. You know, how do you get that done?
Seashells.
Yeah.
You know, look, there. I mean, folks, this system has been established. The fiat system has been established for a very long time. They're not going to make it easy for you to escape. Yeah,
it really does. It just locks you in. It just locks you in. But anyway, okay, so what would be, let's say you've got this all set up, but what would Jason Hartman do once he starts looking for the right property in Argentina? Would you focus on BA because that's kind of the main hub with 15 million people? Or would you maybe go to a Mendoza and wine country because it'd be easier to Airbnb and that's a town of about 1.1 million? Or would it be Cordoba, which is more of a university town? What would Jason Hartman do there?
Yeah, I don't know. It just depends on where you are in your life and how concerned you are about civil unrest. I mean, look, if things are really chaotic, you don't want to be around a lot of people. And what you want to do is you want to be somewhat separated from people in a place where it's, you know, more community oriented, more rural, and a place where you have resources, where you have land that's arable that you can use, right? You want to have
to be clear, this real estate property is to give you cash flow.
Right.
So you can buy food and other things that you need on a monthly basis.
Yeah. Well, you can get cash flow from farmland. You know, you can work with sharecroppers. There's all kinds of stuff you can do. I mean, the yield is not very good on farms. I mean, we've looked at that 100 times over the years and it's just a very low producing yield. You know?
Okay. So I think what I'm hearing you say is you'd have to go there and figure out what your objectives are. It's like we were talking about earlier and what your priorities are. And then you would just have to do some boots on the ground research and go from town to town and just kind of start with a checklist and see which properties, check the most boxes.
Right. But, you know, one other thing you should think of is that you can largely do a lot of that within the United States. I mean, you can, to some extent, check out of the system in the U.S. If you live in a rural area here and you can grow your own food and you're off the grid pretty much, I mean, you don't really need money. OK, you don't need currency. Think of the Great Depression, right? If you read like I had Amity Schles on my show years ago, she wrote The Forgotten Man, right? You're probably familiar with this book or her work. She's great. And, you know, the people in the countryside, like if you saw that old show, The Waltons, when you were a kid, right? Mm-hmm. The people in the countryside really weren't, their life didn't change that much during the Great Depression. They didn't go to a soup kitchen. They just grew their own food. Okay. They were independent already. I mean, yeah, it wasn't as good as it was in the past, but, you know, they just kept living their life, you know, good night, John boy. I mean, it's not like they were very affected. The people who were affected were the people who were dependent on the system. And when the system broke down, they were in lines for soup kitchens and, you know, they went from jobs working on Wall Street to starving. Okay.
So, you know. Yeah. Yeah. And on that point, I had Ali do some research for me. And he just found this one property that's just maybe 20 or 25 minutes outside of that area where Doug has that big complex. I think it's called La Estancia, something like that.
I don't know.
I think it's called the Salta province. But anyway.
I've only been to Bariloche and you know, that's the only place I've been in the country in Argentina is just Bariloche.
Yeah, but this online, and you know, you take it for what it's worth. But it was about 16 acres. It was kind of a vineyard slash farm. You know, you got your chickens. I'm sure it's got its own source of water and whatnot. But you know, for a family, you could do all those things that you're talking about in the Waltons on this type of property, and it was like a couple hundred grand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's not expensive. I mean, these are cheap properties because they're rural, and you know, that's the deal.
Yeah. All right. So on that bombshell, Jason Hartman is going to become a farmer.
No, I'm not.
The next time we do an interview, I want you to have a whole spread of all the food that you just grew yourself. And you've prepared into this incredible buffet.
Probably not going to happen. you know, it's funny you mention that because my mother grew up on a farm in upstate New York. And every summer as a kid, she would send me to upstate New York to live with my grandparents for the summer. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've definitely milked cows and, you know, dealt with farm animals and grown food and all of that kind of stuff. And even in our little apartment in Mar Vista, California, I was growing tomatoes. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'm definitely not completely unaware of that life, but I don't want to go back to it.
All right. Now, I want to point out that you're going to be at Rebel Capitals Live here. Yeah. And a few months, something like that.
Oh, like a month, right? What are we, about a month out?
Yeah, I guess, well, no, what are we? It's, I lose track of the time here. Yeah, I guess we're about, maybe a month, 6 weeks. Anyway.
And before Rebel Capitalists, we're having our collective event, which is private for the collective mastermind members. And it's sort of added on to Rebel Capitalist Live. So that's exciting too.
Yeah, but I'm sure you're going to be talking more about real estate at Rebel Capitalist Live as opposed to your green thumb.
Yeah, no, definitely not going to give farming tips. Or, but the one tip I would say is stay away from Monsanto and their hybrid seeds. I mean, what a scam that is. Can you believe it, George? You know, this evil corporation who, you know, the Obama administration appointed the former CEO as their head of agriculture, that basically is controlling whether or not we can grow crops more than once from the same seeds. I mean, that's just insanity. That's just disgusting.
Oh. Yeah. All right. Well, if you want to hear more about the real estate market, how it pertains to Monsanto, definitely pick up your tickets, Rebel Capitalist Live. You can do that at rebelcapitalistlive.com. And Jason, if people want to find out more about what you do, what are you doing on social media lately?
Yeah.
Doing YouTube or Instagram?
You know, I'm really quite big on Instagram, not necessarily too on purpose. YouTube, I think, has sandboxed me. I can't seem to grow my channel much. I'm at about 80,000 subs and it just sits there. So it's frustrating. But yeah, I'm on YouTube, podcast. Just look up Jason Hartman either place, and Instagram, and jasonhartman.com for my main website.
All right, buddy. Pleasure talking to you. We'll see you soon.
Likewise. Good talking to you.